Okay now?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, this was a Margaret Stretfield case that I sat through, both hearing her interview and being present at her discussions with the doctor and so on about this man who was an old tuberculosis patient attending the dispensary and worried about his daughter, aged about 15, who had suddenly left home and got herself a job in some village in, I think, Surrey. And he didn't know if she was all right or not, and he and his wife were terribly upset that their daughter had done this thing. They couldn't understand it. They described this girl, whose name was Gladys, who was so fond of little bits of jewellery, and altogether he didn't understand this younger generation person, and he was totally bewildered as to what he ought to do about a girl who'd gone in a country village, really wasn't very far away, but to him was another world, what he ought to do about this. And he couldn't help talking about his problem when he came to the hospital for his checkup every so many weeks, and Margaret Stretfield picked this up. And I can recall this interview going on for quite a long time, with her asking rather carefully what the girl was like and what his wife, who wasn't present, thought about all this and how it had come about and so on. And then in this interview, which she was meeting this man for the first time, though he was an old patient with a huge case paper, she said to him very tentatively, "It happens that I know the vicar's wife in that village. She's a friend of mine. It's just a fluke, but she is. I could, if it's wise, put an inquiry through to her to see if this girl is all right and if this family that she's boarding with and presumably working from, if they're all right. But I don't know," she said, "whether it's really wise to do this, whether it's really wise to interfere in this way. And I do think that you and your wife ought to consider very carefully whether that is the right thing to do. Take time to think it over, and we'll discuss it when you come back, because it might make things worse," she said. And he was obviously enormously helped by having talked to somebody outside the family circle about this, and agreed that he would try and work out with his wife whether they ought to pursue the girl, or whether the fact that she had moved away, but that they knew where she was something that they should take much more time over and so on. And now that was typical, really, of the way in which she worked. And I was fortunate, because I was at a stage where I wasn't too clear about the method, but I could see that to some extent it meant, if people seem to want to do something or move in a certain way, you may as well let them do it, because it's probably the right thing to do.
Yes.
And I found that exceedingly helpful, and something very good to go out of training with.
Yes.
So when you say, why didn't people write it more? Well, you'll see that they did write it in some of the pamphlets I've given you about principles.
Yes.
But they were very much struggling to assert the social work activity through all this welter of dentures and artificial limbs and hearing aids, and this burden that they'd got on them by then of patients' contributions, which they did regard as a burden, and yet they didn't want patients to suffer by somebody doing it worse. Great dilemmas, really.
Fantastic parallel with the predicament of social workers in some social service.
Exactly. It is exactly. It's very interesting how it is. And you did have to work very hard with the older generation of doctors, you know. They were tough.
Yes.
They couldn't communicate very easily with patients themselves. Nursing staff were great allies.
Yes.
Occasionally they were rivalrous.
Yes.
But on the whole, they were great allies.
Yes.
And so, on the whole, were the administrators, but the doctors, the top men, were really tough.
Can you remember any stories about, well, you've told me one story about the fur coat lady.
Yes. I remember it more when I was in a job, the sort of rows that one had with doctors, and the difficulties. I mean, the younger ones were always better. I mean, they were younger, you could deal with them more. And of course, that's paid off, because I notice now when the consultants are now, those people who in my day were the young men that you could work with, how very different they are. I mean, people still complain of doctors, but they're enormously different than they were they were then. And they do learn much more to communicate with doctors. I do recall, this isn't my story, it's one from my colleague later, who had a young doctor trying to persuade a very sick woman that she should not discharge herself from hospital because of the sort of condition she had, trying to persuade her to stay. Now, she had a bad condition, but she was also pregnant. And it was thought that she didn't realize she was, and this was an additional reason why she really ought to stay in hospital and not risk going home. And all this young man could say to her to persuade her was, but you have a gravid uterus. Now, either he didn't know the word pregnancy or he was too embarrassed to use it, but he couldn't communicate with her because what did that mean to her? It meant nothing.
It didn't mean anything to me.
Exactly,
you just explained.
You can see what it... And the fact is that these, on the whole, very middle-class young men had no means often of communicating with people. They really didn't know how to do it. But I did see this much more later as a student. I was thankful to hear these stories about these difficult consultants, but I was dealing more with registrars and housemen at that level, who really were, on the whole, much better. They were one's peers, more likely. But later, of course, when I was in a job, there were lots of ways of thinking, you know, what's this man interested in? And what are the ways of dealing with him? If he's a person who is very impatient in a clinic, but has a bad conscience 2 hours later, then you have to arrange that somehow you are in his way 2 hours later. And he says to you, I've been thinking about that woman, I don't think we made the right decision. One wasted perhaps a lot of time in being sure that one was available 2 hours later. But you really had to think, how does this person work? Because I tended to work in places where there were extremely good staff and you did respect them for their skill. But you had also to think of the pressures on them and what some of the ways in which what you wanted to do could pick up with what their interests were. Because they cared terribly. That their patient should be all right. But they often weren't very imaginative or were too busy with their own preoccupations to want to be involved personally. I think there was a lot of this. They couldn't afford to widen their interests too much because of the sort of decisions they had to make.
So where did you go after your training?
Now, when I finished training, this was November 1938, when there'd been the Munich crisis. And everybody who had a job was staying in it, and everything was at a standstill, nobody was expanding, and there were about 20 of us out of work. And we met at all the jobs. You know, wherever you went, they were part of the gang being interviewed as well. We made quite a profitable use of this, because the first person into the interview would come back and say, look, the snags are this and this and this and this. It's a terrible committee and they're all this, they want this done and they want that done. And the rest of us, we were all allowed to sit and wait on our own, together, you see. So we would then work out a strategy. All right, X is going to say she couldn't dream of taking the job unless they'll appoint a clerk. Y is going to say there must be a telephone. The other one was going to say there must be a proper office. So that, because we knew only one of us could get the job. And the thing to do was to bargain it up. And we were very efficient about this over a year. I did some locum work, but very short. Then, because my family were terribly tolerant, they were all, you know, there were no grants. I mean, you trained on your family's back, and mine were not well off, but they were willing for me not to go into any job if I felt it was wrong. I was offered a job with the LCC on their waiting list. They had some jobs coming up, and they said they would be prepared if I would like to put me up for one of those. But I'd seen LCC work, where you spent all your time getting assessment information for the relieving officer to handle, and I just felt that that was a dead end at that moment, and I couldn't have coped with it. So I did care committee work for the LCC as a fill-in, and was offered a care committee job, but I didn't feel I wanted to do it. It was limited.
An organiser's job, you mean?
Well, they would have offered me an organiser's job, that's right. Yeah. But as a care committee worker, I was the volunteer who looked after two schools. And it was very helpful. I could use my social work knowledge and I could get on well with the staff. I mean, having learned how to work in a hospital, I could transfer that to seeing how to work in a school.
Yes.
It was interesting. I kept my hand in. I had to think very hard, because I didn't get much help from the organisers, as to how far I went with the home visiting I was doing, what I said to the school teachers and so on. It could have been a job, but I felt I'd been trained for something which was more a professional job. I didn't want to be a district junior organiser or whatever. So I held on. And then as soon as the war started, I got a job in 1940 at an evacuated hospital. That was Hemel Hempstead based hospital. It was the workhouse. But evacuated there was part of Great Ormond Street Children's Hospital and part of University College Hospital. And we were that part, but the matron was the workhouse matron of the whole place. And it was absolutely fascinating. Again, we had very skilled doctors, very skilled nurses, Great Ormond Street nurses, ward sisters, and University College Hospital ward sisters. So the hospital part, with it in its orange boxes, was excellent.
Yes.
And the workhouse part was rather crowded up on its own, but gradually, of course, these very able physicians wandered into the workhouse and came out saying, I've never seen conditions like this. These old people, you know, geriatrics was an unknown word, but they were beginning to say, here are medical conditions that I don't understand, but they do need somebody doing something, not just the local GP popping in once a week. And, of course, the children's work that we got from Great Ormond Street was very elaborate, terribly sick children, very skillful work. In those days, they were afraid of mothers bringing in infection, so that visiting was terribly limited. Great problems of distressed mothers seeing children through screens and so on. Terribly difficult. And we also got the sick army at that stage, because this was the phony war period and the dogfights overhead. But the bombed folk from the East End used to come straight out from the, you know, having spent a night in a London hospital and then being moved out to us in big motor coach ambulances. And those I found very interesting to work with. We weren't terribly hard pressed for work. There were two of us. I was the junior with a clerk. And the clerk learned to do all the emergency medical counting of beds and so on. So we were free to spend a lot of time with patients in that phony war bit. But they weren't, wasn't really phony, because we got these air raid casualties who had been buried for hours before they were dug out and weren't desperately injured. The desperately injured they would keep in University College Hospital or Charing Cross or somewhere in town. But those who were wounded but could be moved came out to us. And what I found was that these people needed to talk. They talked and they talked repetitively about this experience of being buried and wondering if you would be found. There's one woman who was always so thankful that she pinned a pound note to her corsets because she thought something might happen to her, so at least she had a pound. And but these repetitive stories, and since I had time to go back and listen, I used to wonder, what should I do about this? I didn't know what this reaction was. I'd never heard of it. But, so I used to say to myself, well, what would Margaret Stretfield do? She would say, if they seem to need to talk, you'd better let them. So I used then to go back to these people and just sit it out, the fact that the story was being repeated. I couldn't do anything about it. And so I used to go and sit and listen, and then, of course, found that after a while they stopped talking about it and were able to be much more in the present. So that, for me, that was one of the applications of what I've been observing at Brompton in the last training stages. And we had some fun there. We were all on our own, it was blackout. We had great, I mean, the doctors and the doctors' wives, the nurses and the social workers were all friends together. Much companionship.
So that's interesting. I mean, it's difficult for me, listening, you know, sort of kind of weighing up. So is it you fortuitously had a fantastic combination of supervisors and experiences. I mean, it can't just be that. It must be also you recognising the fact of what you were being presented with. I mean, there's a bit of you in there too.
Oh, yes, you had to find for yourself what your job was,
yes,
because nobody could help you with this one.
I mean, and the gold dust that was offered, being offered.
Oh, yes. Yes, and also, you see, if you hadn't much to do, you didn't really want to spend it fiddling about in the office. You did spend a lot of time, and I found this as the war went on, because I moved to Oxford after a while, to the Radcliffe. Now there, the war was much worse. We were getting head injuries and terribly bad injuries flown straight in from the battlefields of France. They were coming straight in from the to the Radcliffe by air.
The first war, or after the D-Day landing? Yeah. Where are we at?
Let me think. I must have moved in about 43.
Yes.
I think for the Dunkirk business I was there, and we got some of those, but also I was there also for the D-Day business.
Yes,
and that would be the head injuries that we got straight from there, and the terribly bad abdominal injuries and so on. What happened was that they would dress them at a field station in France or Belgium, wherever they were, and fly them straight to Oxford. And these were terribly injured men. Often you couldn't speak to them. But what a large bit of the job then was helping straight surgical ward sisters and doctors to cope with that sort of thing. Because that happened a bit at Hemel Hempstead as well. Because if you've got somebody very badly injured, although the London hospitals got the worst of that, doctors in casualty were terribly upset at these ghastly injuries, which they'd never been trained for. I mean, bomb damage to people. Yes. It's terribly distressing. And certainly, when I was at Oxford, I moved from the Radcliffe to the Churchill, where we got, again, many of these terribly wounded men from the battlefield, young men. And ward sisters from the surgical ward, who'd been trained to do gynecology or straight hernias and things like that, used to come down to the social work office and say, I had to get away. I can't go back yet. And I recall a lot walking around the vegetable patches with ward sisters, talking about their wards, and saying, I'll have to go back soon. I can't leave the nurses, but I can't go back yet. And talking about these patients that they found so terribly upsetting, these young men that were obviously going to die very, you know, slowly or quickly.
Yes.
And the real support work that one had to do to the staff.
Yes.
And it always seemed to me extremely appropriate that they knew they could come to the social work office. And they knew that, they used to say, at times, because they were so upset themselves, they were rude to us if we went up to the ward and they couldn't bear it, but they knew that it wouldn't make any difference next time we met.
Yes.
And they did look on us as an outlet.
Gosh,
and so that, you know, everybody was doing all sorts of odd jobs because it was wartime, you did
you
all
see
sorts of extra things.
Casualties?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
And was it, I mean, did you find it?
Oh, yes, but then I wasn't actually having to handle them.
Yes.
You know, but yes, I mean, some of the wards, when you went in, everybody was strung up and had drips, and you knew that a great number of them were going to die. It was terribly difficult, and for the young nurses and the young doctors it was frightful, but the older people as well found their defences weren't sufficient for this.
Yes.
And of course they were all so tired, the staff were so tired, these men needed so much doing. And it was extremely stressful.
It's all like echoes of Testament of Youth.
Yes. Yes, although that was an earlier war.
Yeah, sure.
But all the same, it's like that. And also, of course, we were living in blackout, and there weren't many raids for us, but when you went home to London for the weekend, you were in that as well. So, yes. On the other hand, you also had a lot of local patients.
Yes.
And Oxford was fun for that. People in from the Berkshire Downs and all over. And often the nurses who needed to get in touch with relatives outside, or district nurses or whatever, had no idea how to do that.
Yes.
So they'd come down to say, I must get this woman back to Shipton under Wychwood. But I must get somebody to fetch her, and it must be somebody who can come and understand all the medical instructions. What can you do about this?
Yeah.
So you'd get out the telephone directory and you'd ring up the post office or the general shop in which Shipton under Wychwood. You could tell that from the ordinary, you know, Kelly's Guide or whatever. You'd ring up and say, can you help us? It's the Radcliffe Infirmary. And they'd immediately say, yes, what do you want? And you'd say, I want to get a message to Mrs. So-and-so at such and such. Sometimes they'd say, oh, hold on, she's just going out of the shop. And or else they'd say, oh, well, there's a boy with a bicycle. He'll take a message and get her to phone back. And you did find that you could ask for any help in that area by saying, we are the hospital, will you help us? And of course, the nurses soon learned to do that for themselves. We didn't need to go on doing that. But you had to use your knowledge of resources in all sorts of ways there, really. I stayed there after the war, so that we then were moving into the social medicine phase. We had about one of the first professors of social medicine and all those attempts going on. But it was a very rewarding kind of work.
I can't help commenting that it's all, as you've been describing your work and the things you did, when you were just describing that last thing about getting into contact with a local shopkeeper, for example, Kaplan, key people.
Yes, that's right.
And then when you were describing, you know, working with on the organisation, Pincus and Minow. A lot of the contemporary books that have conceptualised these things, like conceptualising things, but have been going on for a very, very long time.
That's right.
And not actually saying anything.
Yeah. They are clarifying it. They're drawing it together, whereas one looked upon it much more as a sort of day-to-day chore. But nevertheless, one thought a lot about how it had to be done.
Yes.
I mean, I had a head almoner at Oxford who used to say, it's going to take us 3 years to get this. Well, never mind, we'll bring it up each year. And by the time they've turned it down three times, the committee or whatever it was, they'll be getting used to the idea and they'll be saying, we'll have to do something about this. So we used to work on that sort of span. When I was at Oxford, though, and during the blackout, the head almoner I had was Helen Rees.
Yes.
Who's still alive. Now, her brother was Jack Rees, who was then director of the Tavistock Clinic.
Yes.
And Helen, who'd come back from Australia because of the war and had a lot of widespread medical social work experience, she knew that Bowlby at the Tavistock was wanting to do some kind of discussion on relationships with patients. And I don't know how this came about, but there was a discussion group at the Tavi with John Bowlby and Noel Honeybun and I think Olive Cross and COS and Helen and myself and another of the Oxford almoners, Francesco Ward. There may have been somebody else as well. Helen was a friend of Betty Irvine. They'd been at Cambridge together. But I don't think Betty was actually in on this. And this would be, I suppose, probably in 44 or 45. And Bowlby, at that point, I think, had published 40 Juvenile Thieves, but nothing else. And we were discussing together, I recall, several blackout trips, what you were doing in interviewing, and whether what we were doing was similar to what he, as a psychiatrist, was doing. I was working in the VD clinic at the Radcliffe at that time, and I can recall our discussing how in an interview, by your movement or your tone of voice, you were trying to convey a great deal to the patient about accepting this person. I mean, this was particularly significant in VD interviews, for example. Not moving too fast, being careful how you move the things on your desk to supply, to imply a kind of ease and acceptance, and not horror, and not disapproval, and keeping a level voice, and all sorts of things like this, which Bowlby was interested in, because he said that he, treating patients, was doing the same things. And this was you know, this was very, very stimulating. We were, in our own department, having quite a lot of discussions about cases at this point, trying to find our own way and discuss cases. Helen had come through the States. She'd known of Gordon Hamilton and Florence Hollis. You see, we couldn't get those books.
Yes.
Because of the war.
Yes.
But she knew they existed, and she had met those people, so she was way ahead of the rest of us, but she didn't thrust any theory on us. But she did encourage us to have a lot of case discussions, which we were trying to do.
Yes.
And there were people in other places who were also trying to do this. The influence of the PSWs who'd done that early training in the States was very considerable. They were around, they were in groups and so on. And we were trying to do it as well. But certainly those times with Bowlby were rather bewildering, because he's a, you know, he's a fumbling kind of person when he's talking. But very encouraging to us, who were trying hard to think what was going on and what was happening. So that, well...
You make it... I'm not sure whether you've never worked in a bad hospital, or you know, where your working situation has been difficult, or whether you've always made the best of whatever you've found and come out the other side.
Well, I mean, there was a great grapevine, and you knew the places where more experienced and better people had failed, and which you kept clear of. There were blacklists. I think I was lucky in that...
You mean a formal blacklist or an informal blacklist?
Well, there was an informal blacklist the Institute had of certain places that nobody should go to, except a very experienced person who didn't mind something very tough, but where often they'd failed and come out. So you could find out a lot about places when you apply. I was always very careful where I applied.
You could phone up the Institute.
Or you could get in touch with your old training almoners and say, what do you think?
Yes.
I mean, it was small enough for everybody to know everybody, so there was always plenty of information. You perhaps had contemporaries who'd been students there.
Yes.
You could find out. And after all, it wasn't a very large profession, you know. About 300 people in practice at that time, I think. So, so I was at places where the medical and nursing standards were good.
Yes. And where they had a good understanding of their social work department and the way in which...
Yes, you had to present it, but you were dealing with people who cared tremendously for their job, so that you could really find a link.
Yes.
This was true. You really could find it.
Yes.
But though you often had to work for it.
Yes.
And you had to get to the point where they trusted you.
Mm.
You know, they really had to find that you performed.
Yes.
You came up with the goods. And I didn't always have an easy time at Oxford. There were some very difficult doctors there who were very impatient of social work and thought that we interfered and so on. I mean, there were fights. Well, I remember a colleague having manipulated somehow so that a patient with whom she was an outpatient for whom she felt a lot of concern didn't go to the consultant himself but to the registrar, because she felt the registrar would handle this woman much more sympathetically. The consultant found this out and came in absolute fury with her for having interfered with his patients. And she stuck it out, but it was an extremely awkward situation, and she had to go to the head of department, Helen Rees, and say what had happened. And Helen said, look, I would defend you, as you know, in any fight like this and come to help, because she always did, but you really were in the wrong. You took a risk and it went wrong, and I can't really defend you, although I'm very sympathetic with you, for having tried to manipulate so that the patient got a certain kind of service. So she said, this is one of the occasions where I cannot go to this very senior, he was a senior physician of the hospital, and row with him for having been so rude to one of my staff, because you were in the wrong. To which the colleague said, yes, I know I was in the wrong. It just failed to come off.
Yes.
And there were occasions, I mean, there was one of the surgeons with whom I never got on with well, because he felt I interfered with his patients. Now, my successor got on quite well, and a fresh start was a good idea. But if you were trying to persuade somebody that a patient had a problem that needed sorted out and could the surgery be postponed so that you could get this sorted. Sometimes you could get it done, but sometimes they were so angry because they saw this as interference. I worked with the gynecologist, John Stallworthy, who is still alive but retired, who was a very, very able gynecologist. They used to call him the Oxford and District Pelvic Floor Repairing Company. It's one of these horrible jokes. But he was brilliant at these ghastly operations of prolapses, which these poor women had suffered with for years and years and years. He was superb. And I remember one patient saying to me, one simple woman, "Mr. Stallworthy is such a marvellous man that if he wanted to cut my head off and turn it round and put it on the other way, I would let him do it." Well, he was a superb doctor. He was terribly quick, so that people emerged dazed. He'd given them excellent information and advice, but at such a speed they couldn't take it in. So I used to be the picker-up of bits. And I really used to sit with those patients and say, "Can you tell me exactly what he said?" And gradually, and they'd used to say, "He didn't say anything." So I'd say, "No, well, but he probably used some words. So if you think about it, can you tell me what he said?" Until they could do this. And then we'd be able to start talking about what this meant. They got to come in for an operation, what it would mean, how long it would take, what they were going to do, what they were going to say to their family when they got home, and so on. Now, Stallworthy would be appalled by the queue outside my door and burst in at times and say, "How can we help you?" It was again, you see, this was extremely stimulating because you really were doing something to try to help people to work it out, so that by the time they left the hospital, they were actually working on the problem. I think now I was too reassuring to many of them that they would cope and that they would be all right. But as a matter of fact, he was such a good surgeon that they were. But I'd got to that because I found when I took that work over from an untrained worker, that his wards were constantly having crises. Ward sister saying, "Here's a woman who's supposed to be going out, her family can't cope, she's made no plans." And I used to get so irritated working with crises, which I felt could have been foreseen. So that was why I got onto the outpatient work, thinking, if we get these people, who are going to be on a waiting list for 6 months, so they've got time, if we can get these people working on the problem as soon as they leave the outpatients, by the time they come in, they're all quite capable people who can make their own plans, but it does need some thinking about. So, you know, it's very stimulating to have these problems and to begin to find the way around them. Stallworthy was marvellous. I mean, we had the day when the plumbers had to do something urgent in the clinic. So he said, "That's all right, we'll carry on. We'll just put screens round the plumbers." So the plumbers were having to listen to all these histories being asked about behind screens and so on. And they retreated for coffee and they never came back. So, you know, in lots of ways, you could see a problem, think, what have we got to find out about this? What have we got to know about it? And what are some of the ways of working on it? So there was plenty in those places. If you were really dealing with very good staff, that was the point, I think. It could be much duller in a slower kind of place. Can not the places where I was, but there were people who left saying, "This is a lousy job." And of course, anybody who married was expected to leave then. And the idea of coming back wasn't all that widely spread.
You were expected, do you mean literally that you were expected to leave if you married?
It was assumed by everybody that you would wish to do so. I don't think there would have been a problem about employing a married woman. It just didn't arise. And those people did not really expect to come back to work, although I know that many of them now have, so they've changed their minds. I was thinking that the war coming gave the almoners a great opportunity because the emergency medical service, which was a trial run for the National Health Service, put an end to all these patients' payments and things. So that, I mean, the contributory schemes kept on, but they took care of so much that gradually the almoners were able to get out of that administrative chore. It was important not to get caught up with new ones, and the Ministry of Health, whatever it was in those days, and the Emergency Medical Service did begin to make pronouncements that almoners are there for the service of the patient. So that things really began to look up a great deal. One still had to work out rather carefully what the job ought to be, because you then hadn't got the excuse of all these wretched patients' payments and so on. And there still had to be new processes in hospital to take care of a big bureaucratic organization. They had to have far more records and registry and so on, which they hadn't always had very much. So one could only step out gradually, but it did make a difference. And I suppose something else that made a huge difference to us quite soon after the war was the number of American social workers who felt that they wanted to come to Europe and make a contribution through having been out of it. And they came particularly through the United Nations. I don't know whether you've come across that. But there was an American working in Geneva for the United Nations, an American social worker named Marguerite Pohek, who was a friend of Gordon Hamilton and Florence Hollis and Lucille Austin and a great number of people, Cora Cassius and so on, of that generation. And she got them over to give seminars, or Cora Cassius to go to the Amsterdam school and teach. So that there were these international seminars held somewhere in Europe, usually one each year for quite a while. I suppose perhaps this would have been 1946, 47 until the early 50s. I was lucky because I was encouraged to go and remember sitting at the feet of Gordon Hamilton out on a lake landing stage in Finland. And thinking to myself, how ludicrous, this is impossible. Especially when we all had sauna together, so that you saw all these people in various stages. And really, because it was known that all this intellectual development and writing was going on in the States, but with the book shortage and so on, there was this great backlog to catch up with in the later 1940s. I think that many of us were sort of starved, and these opportunities were just marvellous.
You were still at the Radcliffe?
I was still at the Radcliffe. I stayed at the Radcliffe until 1949. And by that time, they had an emergency training scheme, a shortened training. An emergency training scheme. The Institute of Hospital Almoners. It had joined up with the Professional Association by then, and had become the Institute of Almoners.
Can you just explain that to me? Because I didn't realise until quite recently there was an Institute of Hospital Almoners, and there was another. There were two organisations.
There were two organisations always, and they joined up. The two organisations were the Hospital Almoners Association, which was the professional organisation, and the old Institute of Hospital Almoners, which was a training body, which had to fight its way free, rather, from the COS. And they were twin bodies, closely linked, until, I forget which date, it is in my book, the booklet I've given you, when the Professional Association took over the training body from the old Free Council, which used to run it, and was largely doctor-dominated, doctor and COS, and they became jointly the Institute of Almoners. So they, after the war, started an emergency training course to run for three intakes, when, with a lot of academic help, they put on a shortened combined training of academic and practical work, a lot of support from the government, for people who'd come out of the services. A few men, largely women, older on the whole, I mean, late 20s onwards. And they ran this emergency course for three intakes, so it must have taken 4 years or so to do. And they wanted to send a group of these students for their practical work to Oxford. Mm. So as one of the social workers there who had had a student or two in the old arrangement, I became a sort of tutor on the spot for the students while they were in the hospitals. Mm. So I wasn't their immediate supervisor, they were farmed out to different social workers, but I was responsible for their program, for their progress, for some seminars with them and general arrangements. Mm. So then I started, and from that I moved as senior tutor to the Institute of Almoners in 49.
I see, yeah.
And from then onwards was in teaching jobs, except that I had a lovely year in the States, where I did some practice in 53 to 4.
So 49, that'd be about the time you were, perhaps before then even, I've not quite yet been drawn into that little group that put together Social Caseworking Regime.
That's right, yes, that was published in 50.
Yes.
I think I was at Oxford for it. Mm. We came up to London for constant discussions all together, Una Cormac, Cherry, Morris, and the other people who were contributing.
Yes.
I know that Mr. Min, do I mean Mr. Min, probation officer,
right.
Vanished in the middle of it all to New Zealand or whatever, and his bit was, it was quite uncertain as to when his bit would arrive.
What? He immigrated.
He immigrated, yes, he did. So, yes, we took a jolly long time over that book, but that's right, we came together for lots of discussions as to how it was to be done.
You did all meet together for discussions?
We all met for discussions, and it was worked out what Kay McDougall and Una Cormac were to do with their big ones, and then how the rest of us were to go off into our separate ones. But the probation bar was always a kind of query, because it was so uncertain what was going to emerge.
Because when I recently read the book, things that struck me was how the different contributions sort of reflected the different generations of the people contributing.
This is, yes.
Yours and Claire Winnicott's.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, were two that you thrust under the nose of a student today and say...
Well, yes, we were the young ones in the group. This is, yes.
With both those essays.
That's right, we were the younger ones in the group.
There are others which are still couched in a language of an earlier generation.
Yes, that's right,
I wondered what the discussion groups were like.
Well, the discussion groups were largely practical, really, in sorting out who was to do what and what the general line was to be. And Cherry took quite a prominent part.
Yes.
But I don't think we necessarily discussed ideas very much in those gatherings, but we tended to know each other because immediately after the war, I think the COS and perhaps the London Council of Social Service organised seminars. Sorry, because there was such a feeling after the war of needing to catch up with a lot of social work developments, particularly in the States, but generally, because in the war you couldn't move about very much.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a feeling of need to come together, and the British Federation of Social Workers, or its predecessor, and Una Cormac, were full of ideas about coming together.
Mm-hmm.
And among other gatherings, a lot of conferences, we had one at Pendley Manor in Tring, when it was all rationed and we were all terribly hungry, and that they were having a police convention the next weekend, and we suspected that our rations were being saved for the police, and there was some unrationed oatmeal biscuits were unrationed, and there were unrationed oatmeal biscuits at the village shop, and I was one of the first group which discovered these. And the word got around like wildfire, so that as we marched back to Penley Manor across the park with our biscuits, we met Eileen Young Husband and Ben Asprey leading a whole contingent to go and buy biscuits. And I can recall Noel Honeybun and Eileen Young Husband, who had adjacent rooms, I think on the ground floor or near the ground floor, leaning against their doors in the evening, talking to anybody passing by, looking rather like village housewives, chattering. And we were all terribly cold, and there were great crises about blankets and all sorts of things like this, which helped, after all, to weld us all together. And I was one of the reporters of one of the discussion groups, because we then were discussing should we not have a common training course of some kind, and should not all these different branches of social work at least come together in training terms and do very much more together.
And what date's this? This is these discussions. What date are we talking about now? Can you remember?
It'll be in the book. I think it must be the late 40s. It must be the late, the middle to late. No, it may even be 46 or 47. Yes, I mean, we really were saying there should be a training course.
Pre-Carnegie Report.
Oh, yes, leading up to it. Because Eileen was there for all this, you see. And Una was tremendously important in this. And I know my discussion group somehow was so optimistic that it saw various problems, but they could be overcome. And we reported this in the most euphoric terms. But it was the mood that the war was being left behind. We were still being rationed, but at least we could get around, we could see each other, we could find a great wish not to be so divided in our administrative units and so on. And now that, people of all generations were joining in.
This was a discussion group associated with the group?
It was a conference.
It was a conference. Mm,
three or four days. The not the group writing the book. No, it included people writing the book. I mean, I'm sure Kay McDougall was there.
Yeah.
And Olive Cross was. She hadn't retired then. And Ben Asprey. Mm. Eileen Younghusband. Noel Honeybun. Yes. Probably Betty Irvin, but I'm not sure.
So you're actually debating amongst yourselves then, presumably?
Yes, there are about 40 of us.
Versus specialism.
Yes, we wouldn't have used those terms, but we certainly wanted to find a common training and to get rid of the divisions, because we felt that we had much more that was common than was different. So that was really the sort of movement that Eileen Younghusband was in.
Yes,
she didn't become converted to casework until she went to Chicago. She was really rather doubtful about it.
Yes.
But then she went to Chicago and met Charlotte Toll, which did sell it to her, so that when she came back and was using her influence with LSE to get the Applied Social Studies courses started, it started in 54. Now all the working up to that, its relationship with the mental health course was very, you know, peculiar at that point. And it was as though the new stuff coming in from the States wasn't really recognising all that the PSWs had already done. And yet, of course, because they were not a closed group, they were always very outgoing and responsible, but because they always described things in mental in PSW terms, it didn't pick out always the real social component, because it was so much caught up with... Yes, and in...